Hello, good evening. Thank you for sharing your evening with me. My name is Maureen O'Hagan. I'm with MCO Housing Services, and we were hired by the developer of Albion Flats to handle the distribution of two affordable one-bedroom apartments. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the project. We're going to spend time on the eligibility criteria, and most of the time we will spend on the documents you need to provide. So you make sure you submit a complete application, because incomplete applications will not be reviewed. So I've opened the chat. If you have questions, you can type them into the chat. If you want to ask me a question and you do not want it recorded, because this meeting is being recorded and will be posted tomorrow on our website, then let me know. You have a private question. I will turn off the recording. Ask and answer the question, and then I'll turn the recording back on, okay? All right, so Albion's flats are located at 198 Albion Street in Wakefield. Again, 2 one-bedroom flats by lottery for eligible applicants. Eligibility is based on 80% of median income, which I'll get to in a moment. One surface parking space is available at no charge per unit, along with one storage unit. I do not know the size of the unit. Each unit includes a washer and dryer and all kitchen appliances. Pets are allowed. Breed restrictions will apply. And the monthly pet rent is $75 for a cat or a dog. The property is smoke-free. I spoke with the developer today. He's going to be sending me some photos. The project is not finished. I will post them on our website either tomorrow or Monday. But you'll have the opportunity to see what's inside because it's still under construction. It's about a 3-minute walk to the Wakefield Commuter Rail Station, and close to 93 and I-95 and 128. Walking distance to downtown. And you can check out the website at 198albionflats.com if you want to just get a better sense of the property. So the monthly rent is $2,150, which is less than they could have charged. The utilities are all electric, and they are not included in the rent. However, water and sewer is included in the rent. A utility allowance has been deducted, and again, you're paying less than what you could charge by a couple $100. The rent is not subsidized or income-based, so you're responsible for the full rent. If you have a Section 8 or other housing voucher, those are accepted, which would bring whatever they told you you had to pay, but Section 8 will be accepted. If you do not have a voucher or Section 8 or any housing voucher, the minimum income you need to earn is $64,500, and that's the minimum income. The maximum income I'll get to in a moment. The units will be distributed by lottery. Tonight is the public information meeting. The application deadline is April 7th, and the lottery right now is scheduled for April 30th, but depending on the number of applications we receive, we may move that up. Okay, so far we've received 2 applications. So I give myself about a month to review applications, but if we can do it sooner, we will, and we will notify you of that. So in order to be included in the lottery, you need to provide a complete application. And that means you need to complete the application and provide all the required financial documentation, which I'm going to get into great detail at the end. If you submit an incomplete application, we will send you an email listing the documents that were not provided. You will not be included in the lottery. But you will have the opportunity, if you choose to provide the missing documentation, and we will add you to the waiting list should units remain after the lottery. Those who submit a complete application, we will review for eligibility, and eligibility will be, if you're eligible, meeting the program eligibility, you'll be included in the lottery, and you will receive a lottery code. If you are determined ineligible based on the program eligibility requirements, you will, and you disagree with our decision, you will have an opportunity to appeal that decision. And it may or may not work in your favor. I don't know. But you can appeal. I have a couple questions. If the applicant does not meet the minimum income, can they still enter the lottery if they include a completed gift income form along with the lottery application? Yes. And also, What I didn't say and what's not here, because I forgot to put it in, we can take under consideration your income and your assets in determining the minimum income. Okay? I forgot that's not in the application. That's on me. But we will look at both. Okay? Is that considered gross? Yes. The 64.5 is the gross income that will be considered. Okay, so this meeting will be posted on our website tomorrow. So I'm going to move on to the eligibility criteria. Okay, there's two main eligibility criteria. One is income, one is asset. The maximum allowable income for a one-person household is $91,200. And for a two-person household, it's $104,200. More than likely or possibly before the application deadline, HUD will release the new income limits. Once HUD releases the new income limits, we will immediately put them, we will use those, and they typically go up. They tend to be released in April. Last year it was April 1st. I don't know when they'll come out. Your guess is as good as mine. But they will go into effect as soon as they are released. The rent will not change. So the rent has been determined for the initial lease up for the lottery. Now the rent, well, I think of it, is not fixed. It will be adjusted on an annual basis, based on the new income limits. I don't know what the developer will do. You don't have to worry about it for a year, but the rents are not fixed. They will usually increase. They never go down, but they will increase on an annual basis. Now regarding assets, no income, let me go back. Well, this is only one bedroom unit, but any household members 18 years of age or older, their income is considered in determining eligibility, even if, say, the lease is in your name only. I don't think it's going to apply here because it's only one bedroom, but I'm going to say it anyway. So your assets, if you have $5,000 or more in assets, we are going, no, $5,000 or less in assets, we are going to add to your income the interest and dividends you have earned on your assets. If your assets exceed $5,000, we are going to count the greater of the actual interest and dividends earned, or 0.06% of the total value of your assets. So we're going to multiply the total assets by 0.006. And whichever is greater, the interest or dividends of the 0.06% of total assets will be added to your income in determining your income eligibility. So this application that you're submitting to me is going to be used to determine program eligibility. So once, if you're included in the lottery, before you will be offered a unit, you need to go through the leasing office screening as well. They will check credit, pass landlord, whatever they choose to check. If you pass the leasing office screening, then you will be offered a unit. If you have a Section 8 voucher, Section 8 needs, since it's a new development, they need to probably inspect the property, and they have to accept the property and its rent in order for you to move forward in the process. So if we approve you, the leasing office approves you, but Section 8 doesn't, you're not going to be able to rent if you have a voucher. Okay. You cannot own a home and lease an affordable apartment, or lease at Albion Flats. So your home would have to be sold before, you would sign a lease. I don't know if either of you own a home. This unit, there's only two units. So one of the units will be for someone who either currently lives in Wakefield, works for the town of Wakefield, or the Wakefield school system, works for a company located in the town of Wakefield, or has children attending Wakefield school. Any one of those would put you in the local pool, okay? So one unit is local, one unit is open. Those in the local pool will have two opportunities for a unit because they are included in the open pool as well. So there's just the local pool and the open pool. So that's two opportunities. If you're not local, you have one opportunity for a unit, okay? There are no wheelchair-accessible units in this building. If you require a Group 2, there are none. The building, the units are adaptable. If you require reasonable accommodation or modification, you need to let us know at the time of application. And if it can be accommodated, the developer will do that. But you need to provide that in writing and include a copy of a letter from your doctor stating what the special accommodation is. If it's major, if you just need bars in the bathroom or something, that's different. But you need to let us know at the time of application. Now, this is just a one-bedroom unit. So typically, no, these units are for rental only. They're not for sale. So typically for household size preference, and this is in general, these again are one-bedroom units. So you're only gonna, you know, usually be available to one or two-person households, husband and wife or partners or something. But in general, and this is in general for you, there's at least one occupant per bedroom. A husband and wife or those in a similar living arrangement must share a room, and there's one person per bedroom thereafter. That's in general. It's not gonna, again, these are one-bedrooms. If a husband and wife or those in a similar living arrangement would not be required to share a bedroom if the consequence of sharing would have a severe adverse impact on his or her mental or physical health. Again, in order for that to be taken under consideration, we would need a letter from somebody. You can't just request a second bedroom. So that would be a special accommodation, a second bedroom, which, again, doesn't apply here. But that would definitely include a letter from your a doctor. If you are pregnant, the unborn child counts as a household member, and the household must provide proof of pregnancy. If you are going through a divorce or separation, we need documentation regarding that. You have to be far enough along in the process where the household asset distribution has been determined. If you're not that far along, then your soon-to-be ex-spouse or partner, they need to provide the same financial documentation as you need to provide, even if they won't be living in the unit, okay? Now, 33.4% of the local pool applicants need to be minority. If we don't have that number, then we will do what I call a mini lottery prior to the lottery for the units. And we'll move the number of non-local applicants, non-local minority applicants from the open pool into the local pool. If we need to do that, they would then be treated like any local pool applicant and would have two opportunities for a unit. I don't know if we'll need to do that. I won't know until we sit down and review the applications. And then I won't know until everyone's been reviewed, we've determined who's eligible to participate in the lottery, and then we look at the minority status of each of the applicants. And we will only look at that if we have a local pool applicants, which we may or may not have. But the local pool is for the initial lease-up only. So once the application deadline, once April 7th passes, there is no more local pool, meaning if someone applies later and they're from Woburn, they have no priority for that unit. So the priority only extends to those who apply for the lottery and are eligible, and we give you a lottery code. All right. On an annual basis, these are an affordable unit, so you have to have the income eligibility. Annually, your eligibility will be redetermined, what we call recertification. So you are eligible, for example, for a single person at $91,200. In order to be eligible for this lottery, that's 80% of median income, and that's HUD median income. At recertification, the median income goes up to 140%. So, for example, if we were looking, you're a one-person household, and to qualify, the max is $91,200. At recertification, you can then earn up to $127,680. Before you would be determined ineligible. So what that does is it gives you some room to earn more money, so you're not going to have to move every year, okay? So that's on recertification. But again, for your initial lease-up, it's $91,200 for a one-person household and $104,200 for a two-person household. Now, the recertification probably will be done by us. You will receive notification 90 to 120 days before your lease is up, and we'll give you 2 weeks to collect all your documentation and send it back to us. We need to have your recertification done before your lease renewal. And also before the time frame you need to give notice to the property if you're not going to renew your lease. Okay, so we start early. All right. We've talked, wrong page. All right, any questions so far? Okay, so we're going to move on to the lottery process. So like I said, two units, local pool, open pool. Local pool applicants will select their unit first. If you have been determined eligible and included in the lottery, you will receive a lottery code from us prior to the lottery. The lottery code is just a mishmash of the letters in your name. We call out the lottery code. We don't call out your name to protect your privacy. You do not need to participate. You do not need to log in. It will be done via Zoom. If you can't make the lottery, it is not going to affect your lottery ranking. And the highest ranked applicants in the local pool and the open pool that require a one-bedroom unit will have the initial opportunity to lease the two units. If they don't, aren't interested, or they go through the process and then are determined ineligible, then we'll just work our way down the list to determine the next people who have the opportunity for a unit. If you don't have an opportunity for a unit, then the remaining applicants on the open pool list start the waiting list for future vacancies. All right, so that starts that list. If you're in the local pool, you have two opportunities for a unit. Local pool applicant will select their unit location first, and then the open pool applicant will take the unit that's left over. Again, this is just a one-bedroom unit, but household size shall not exceed, nor the maximum allowable household size be more restrictive than the state sanitary requirements for occupancy of a unit. And again, in general, applicants will not be approved for units larger than their household size allows. So what will happen post-lottery, I will email everyone, including the lottery list as drawn, so you can see where you landed. And then also a second attachment will be on that email where I have broken out the order for people to lease in both the local pool and the open pool. It's pretty basic here because it's only one-bedroom unit, but if there's any differences, and I don't know if there will be or not, if there's any differences, I will attach that list to you at all. That happens usually by the end of the day on the day we do the lottery, okay? If you have the initial opportunity to lease, I will hook you up with the developer where you go through the leasing office screening, look at the available units, select your location, go through the leasing office screening, and hopefully you'll sign a lease and move in. All right. Any questions on the lottery? No? You guys are good. Okay, so I'm just following along in the application, so I'm not going to go over the unit the unit numbers that are available are Unit 4 and Unit 9. And Unit 4 is 550 square feet. Unit 9 is 560 square feet. And the estimated occupancy is April, May. So we've timed this, so the property should be or very close to completion at the time you have the opportunity to lease. So I wouldn't give you notice anywhere yet because it's new construction. There's always delays, always. All right, so the floor plans and the unit locations are included in the application, so I'm not going to go into those too much. So the rest of the tonight we'll go over the application and what you need to submit. Excuse me, I'm on page 10 of the application if you're following along. This page is basically contact information, name, address, phone, email. You let us know if you own a home, if you have a voucher, if you meet local preference, if you require special accommodation, and you provide the names of the people who will be living in the home, including yourself. So your name would be on this twice. You need to provide a guesstimate of your financial, not guesstimate, but what your monthly gross income is for everyone who will be living in the home from all sources of income, and then also your current household assets, checking, savings, stock, bonds, retirement, IRAs, trusts, gifts, whole life or a universal life insurance policy. I'm going to get into detail on each of those moving forward. This just tells us, when you fill this out, it just tells us these are the assets that you have. You are also going to be providing the backup documentation to show us what those assets are. If you are working and not retired, you need to provide your employer information. The section about your household is where we determine your minority status. Again, and that would come into play with the local preference. It's optional. You do not need to complete it if you don't want to. It's up to you. And then you need to sign and date. The next section is the affidavit and disclosure form. You need to read, sign, and date that. And everyone over the age of 18 needs to sign. Okay, so now we're getting to the nitty-gritty. All right, the majority of people who apply for a lottery are not included in the lottery because they submit an incomplete application. Some lotteries, as much as 70 or 80% of the applicants that apply are not included in the lottery, which is great for those who provided everything, but it's frustrating for us because we try to provide as much information as possible so you know what to provide, and the bottom line is people don't read it. So what I've done, I've put together this application tip page. This is where I see most of the issues are. So they're highlighted here, and they're also highlighted on the required financial documentation, the list of financial documentation. So I'm just going to go over these quickly. You need to read the notes. On the list of the required financial documentation, we do provide notes. It's always additional information. If you don't read the notes, it can be the difference between a complete and incomplete application, and it's the difference between your eligible and ineligible, okay? So please read the notes as you go through the required financial documentation. Again, the financial documentation, income, assets, tax return are required from all household adults aged 18 or older. Don't tell me my child is in college. They're over 18. If they may work summers, they may have paid taxes. If they didn't, there's other documentation you'll need to provide. So if your child's in college, that doesn't excuse them from providing that documentation. All asset statements that you provide must include the institution name, your name, and your account number, okay? People tend to pull up their account on their cell phone, which gives them, this is my balance. Usually their name's not on there. Usually the institution name may not be on there. And they submit that for, like, your checking account. Not good enough. So it will not be counted. Each asset statement you provide has to include that information. If it does not, you know, it's an incomplete application, okay? The reason for it, obviously, is if your name's not on it, it could be someone else's statement, and we don't know that. Your account number, we can't match it up to banks, to pay stubs and all that kind of stuff, so we don't know what. And the institution name, we just need that. All right. Do not assume you do not need to provide a certain document. When in doubt, provide it or call us, because that's our job, is to help you if you have questions. Call us and ask us, do we need this information, okay? Don't assume you don't need it. When in doubt, provide it anyways. If we don't need it, it will be shredded, okay? So please don't assume. You are required to provide your 401k, 403b, IRA, Roth IRA, and all that. Some people will say, well, you can see it on my pay stub. That is correct. We can. But what we don't know is the full value of that account. The pay stub is only going to provide us with how much goes in monthly and how much you've paid year to date. It doesn't give us the full value of the account. We need the full value of the account, okay? So you need to provide the actual statements, and I'll get into that in a bit too. If you have a Robinhood account, Acorn account, any Coinbase account, any kind of online investment accounts, you need to provide the latest statement for those accounts. Some people will say, well, I don't have any money in my Robinhood account. I'm like, well, I don't know that. For all I know, you have $1 million in your Robinhood account. So you need to provide the statements. Even if there is a zero balance or a $1.20 balance, you need to provide the latest statement. Okay, if you are unable to provide information, let us know. And if we can work with you, we will. But if we don't know you've had a problem getting a document, we can't assist you, and that's what we're here for. So feel free, if you have special circumstances, you can write a letter and attach it to your application when it comes in. That's fine. We're more than happy to receive the letters explaining things to us. Keeping in mind, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've reviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of applications, and we can't cover everything. Everyone has their own financial circumstances, their own financial setups. So when in doubt, let us know. You can't get something. If we can work with you, we will. I can't guarantee that. But if we don't know your circumstances, there's nothing we can do about it. So feel free to provide a letter explaining your circumstances if it's unusual, if they are unusual. Don't take photos with your cell phone of any documentation and email it to us. 9 times out of 10, it's illegible. It's blurry. It's bumpy, so you can't get a clear view of it. So we won't accept them. So we need you to make copies and PDF everything to us. Don't take photos with your cell phone. You certainly can fax your information to us. I'm more than happy to accept a fax. However, sometimes, depending on where the fax is coming from, like Staples or something, we may not get every page. And if we don't get every page, that's on you, not on us. So that means you would have an incomplete application. Now, the application deadline is April 7th, so feel free. You can make adjustments to your application up until April 7th. After April 7th, we won't accept any other documentation unless you've been determined ineligible and you're providing missing documentation. We won't change anything on your application after the April 7th deadline. All right? Okay, so now we're going to get into the information you must provide with your application in order for it to be reviewed for program eligibility and inclusion in the lottery. First is identification for each household member. Copy of your driver's license is sufficient. Birth certificate, passport, fine. If you have a Section 8 voucher or other housing voucher, you need to provide us with a valid copy with your application. Now, sometimes you can't get one. We will accept a letter from your housing authority that says, yes, you have a voucher. We will accept, I don't know what they're called, but you do interim certifications like every 6 months or something. We would accept that as long as it has your name on it and it has a housing authority on it. But you need to provide us something that states you have a voucher, okay? And if you don't, we're not even going to, we will review your application, but at market value, at where you would be paying the full rent. And so you need to meet the minimum income limit. Again, if you meet the local preference, you need to provide proof. So a copy of your lease, copy of utility bill if you live in Woburn. If you work for the town or school system, you'll have your pay stub. We can see that. If you work for a company in town, the pay stub should say Wakefield. If it doesn't and you don't provide anything else, you're not local. If you have a kid in the school, you need to provide a letter from the school stating that they are enrolled in the school and when they're going to graduate in order to meet the local preference. If you need a special accommodation, again, you need to provide that documentation as part of your application. Most of the time, these are one-bedroom units, so there probably won't be a need for a special accommodation because there's only one bedroom. But if you need something, it needs to be part of the application. All right, so now for the financial documentation. And this form I'm going through is pages 15, 16, and 17. You do need to complete that form and return it with all the required financial documentation when you apply for the lottery. I'm just mentioning that. All right, so income. We determine your income two ways. One, you're going to send us 5 consecutive pay stubs, and we are going to look at the gross pay you earned per pay period, and then we're going to multiply it by the number of pay periods in the year. So it's either going to be 12, 24, 26, or 52, all right, depending on how the frequency of your pay, which we will get that from the dates, your pay dates on your pay stubs. So that's one way we determine your gross income. The second way is we will look at your year-to-date. We will divide that by the number of weeks in the year, and that is, we get that from a website. and then we will multiply that number by 52. Whichever is greater is going to count as your income limit. We also look at what you earned on your 2024 W-2. That's taken into consideration as well. Whichever is greater is going to be the income limit we use to determine your eligibility. If things have changed from your 2024 W-2 is higher than we determined, so if you no longer at that job, you've taken a new job, you're unemployed, whatever it may be, let us know, okay? Just include that with the application. We also look at your pay stubs. First of all, we don't like disqualifying people, so if someone's really close to the income limit or over the income limit, we will look closer at your pay stub, meaning if you get a one-time bonus, we'll take that out in determining your annual income and add it in separately so it's not spread out over 52 weeks. If you're getting expense reimbursement, we can tend to take that out anyway, so that's not counted as income because it is an expense reimbursement. So if you're over income, we will look far closer at your pay stubs to make sure we're not counting something we shouldn't be in determining your income eligibility, all right? So we do look at multiple ways we can do it. Doesn't always work, but we try our best to make everyone eligible that applies. Regarding your pay stubs, again, you need to provide the last five pay stubs. If you have a new job in the last 12 months or since the 2024 W-2s, we need a copy of your job offer letter. If you're no longer with a company you worked for since 2024, you need to provide a letter of separation from your employer, which lets us know you no longer work there and the last day you work there. So it should include the last date of employment for that company. Looking at your pay stubs, we also will know if you have a retirement account because it will state it as it's because it's a deduction. So we'll know that. So we'll know to look for a retirement account when we get to that aspect of your application review. And if you have direct deposit, which most people do, we also will know the bank accounts that your pay stub is going in, whether it's 1, 2, or 5, okay? So I'm mentioning this because some people, you know, have money put away, an emergency fund, they forget they have the account because they never touch it, all right? Well, we're going to see it because most direct deposit, they will have like maybe not the bank name, but they will have the last 3 or 4 digits of the account number, okay, on your check. So we match those up with the bank statements you provide us. So we're going to say if your account's 1, 2, 3, 4, we're going to look for your bank account 1, 2, 3, 4 where your payroll is deposited. If you have another account that maybe gets $50 a month, it's 5, 6, 7, 8, we're going to look for that account as well. So we look very closely where your money is distributed on your bank, on your pay stubs. And then we look at things further on, which I'll get to. So keep that in mind. If you know you may have an account you just don't look at because it's your emergency fund, we still need that information. All right, if you are unemployed, you have received documentation from the DOR that states what your benefits are, how long they're going to last, and then you can get a statement that provides your payment history so we can see when your payment started, how much you've gotten, because sometimes it differs if you're having taxes taken out of it. So we work, your eligibility, again, is based on growth. So if you have taxes taken out of your unemployment, on the payroll history is not going to match what your statement says on what you will get on a weekly basis, which is why we need both, okay? And that would apply for disability, short-term, long-term disability. We need to know how much you're getting. If you're on short-term disability, if you know when you're going back to work, long-term disability, if you are or aren't going back to work, workers' compensation is typically an end date for that. So we need to know that information along with how the gross amount you're getting, because if you're going back to work, say, July 1st, we're going to use the workers' compensation income from April through July 1st, and then your regular salary for the rest of the 10 months or so in determining your income eligibility. So severance pay, if you got a severance packet from a previous job, there's definitely an end date there, but that money counts towards your income until it runs out. So you need to provide us with that documentation. Again, 5 pay stubs, whether you were paid weekly, biweekly, semi-weekly, or monthly, 12, 24, 26, and 52. Some people will send us 3 pay stubs and say, we'll cover 6 weeks. That's great. That's not what we asked for. We need the 5. Anything less than 5, you're out. Okay, if you receive Social Security, retirement, pension, disability, or any other type of periodic receipts, you need to provide us with Social Security. You have the 2025 benefit letter. So you need to provide us with a copy of that benefit letter, and that's all you need to provide. We don't need 5 letters. We just need 1 letter. That'll give us the growth. If you have any deductions from that, for Medicare or whatever, it will show us on that letter. The reason why we need this, we're going to see the Social Security being deposited into your bank account. Yes, we will. But we're not going to know if what's being deposited is your gross or net income, which is why you need to provide us with this documentation, because your eligibility is based on gross income, not net, okay? So that's the same if you're getting a pension on a regular basis, distribution from your retirement funds. We need the documentation of when it was set up and how much you're getting gross every month. Usually it's every month. All right. Any questions so far? Okay. If you receive child support or alimony, if you're getting your child support through the DOR, then again, you can print out statements for how much you're due to get, how often, weekly, biweekly, monthly, and your payment history. So, for example, if you've been awarded, say, $500 a month, and we look at your pay history and you're not getting that, we're only going to count the money you're getting, okay, which is why we need that payment history. So you need to provide that. And the child support payment that tells us how much you're getting, the frequency of it, it also lets us know if you're getting, if they're in arrears, the spouse is in arrears and paying you, and if they're paying the arrears back. We don't include that as part of your child support, but we won't know that until you give us that documentation. If you are getting child support and it was determined based on your divorce agreement and you are actually receiving it, then you need to provide a copy of your divorce papers. If you have been awarded child support and you are not receiving it either through the DOR or from your ex, then you need to let us know that as well, okay? You need to provide something, and I don't know if it'll apply here because it's only 1-bedroom units, but you need to provide documentation that you're not receiving it at all. Now, did I include it in here? Yeah. On page 19 of the application, there's a custody and child support affidavit. You need to fill that out. You can fill this out if you're not getting child support and it's been awarded or not getting it at all. Same for alimony. Alimony is usually dictated based on the divorce agreement between you and the ex. So we would need a copy of that divorce agreement so we can see what the dollar value is. There's usually, not always, an end date for alimony. And we would know what that end date was, because if it's you're ending sometime this year, we're not going to give you the full 12 months of alimony if it ends within this 12-month period. So you need to provide a copy of the divorce papers for that information as well. Now, if you are self-employed, I've been saying gross, your income is based on gross, but with self-employment, as a business owner, your income for the business is based on net, because you have your income and you can deduct your expenses, and that gives you a net income for the month. So your eligibility will be based on an average of your net income for the past 12 months. So what you need to provide is an income and expense sheet for the last 12 months, broken out monthly, so January, February, March, April. If you've done your taxes already for 2024 and you're providing it with your application, we will know what your net income is from 2024, okay, because that will be part of your tax return. So then we really only need January, February, and March for this year. So we'll get your 9 months of income from 2024, and then we'll look at add the 3 months, and we'll get the average to determine your net income. So you do need to provide a spreadsheet with that income. If you're driving Uber or Lyft, do not provide us with every week's pay sheet. You need to do the math. You need to figure out your monthly income, your monthly expenses, because we're not going to figure it out for you. So if you send that, we're going to count it all, and it may put you over income. So you need to break out that. So you need to provide your business checking and savings account. And if you're self-employed, you also need to provide the last 3 years of your federal income tax return. Federal, no state. If you have filed your 2024 federal income tax already, then we need a copy of your 2024 W-2 and 2024 federal income tax return. All right? If you have not filed your 2024 yet, which you won't have to because the deadline's April 7th and we have until the 15th to file, then you need to provide your 2023 and 2024 W-2s, but your 2023 federal income tax return, okay? So if you file 24, we only need 24. If you haven't filed 24 yet, we need the 2023 and 2024 W-2s and or 1099s and the 2023 federal income tax return, okay? Now, if you filed in 2023 and you can't find your tax return, you can request a transcript of your tax return from the IRS. You can either complete Form 4506-T, which you can get a copy of at irs.gov, and submit that to the IRS, which will take 2 to 3 weeks for you to get it back. Or you can go on the irs.gov, set up a password and username, and you can print out a copy of a transcript right from the irs.gov. My understanding, once you have set that up, it takes about 5 minutes, if that, to print out the required documentation. If you did not submit your tax return, a tax return in 2023, then you need to submit a letter from the IRS verifying that you did not file. Again, you can use Form 4506-T and fill that out for verification of non-filing, or you can go on irs.gov, create a username and password, and then you can print out the verification of non-filing form. So you have the two options. The fastest one is to create a username and password, and you can print it right from your account at the irs.gov. You need to send us every page of your tax return that is submitted to the IRS, because we get, depending on what, page one is going to tell us if you got your income, obviously, any interest and dividends, if you receive retirement, Social Security, if you're self-employed, you know, if you own a home, a lot of times that we can determine that. That's just from the first two pages, all right? Now, we're going to know you're self-employed from page one of the tax return. So we're going to be looking for those corresponding pages of your tax return that breaks out your expenses and your income. So you need to provide every page you submitted to the IRS. If you have interest in dividends, there's a page that lists them all. That's going to tell us your bank statement. So we're going to use that, and we're going to look at the bank statements you provided, and we should have this, we should be able to match that list. All right? So just make sure you provide every page that is submitted to the IRS of your federal tax return. Again, don't need state. 2020 for W-2s and 1099s, 2024 obviously must be provided, you should have. If you can't find 2023, then again, you can go to irs.gov and you can print out your wage and income transcript and then just submit the transcript to us. Whether it's, I can't speak for the transcripts, but for the taxes, you have the option for a copy of your actual tax return or a transcript. They will charge you for a copy of your tax return, which is why we are not requiring you to do that, and a transcript will be fine, okay? Now, all right, moving on. Any questions on taxes? No? Okay. Checking accounts. So all asset statements I've already mentioned, it has to include the account number, your name, and the institution. So that has to be on all the statements you provide us. So for your checking and savings account, I'm combining the two because everything I'm going to say is the same. We need your last 3 months statements. So, and that's every page front and back. If you do not get your statements mailed to you anymore, you can go on and you just are paperless. You can go on your account's website and you can print out the e-statements. It's the same thing that you would be mailing to us. What you don't want to do is go in and provide 3 months of a running transaction list. That's not accepted. You need to provide the actual statements that you would have received in the mail. Now, we do look at your accounts incredibly closely, basically with a fine-tooth comb, mainly the deposits. This is where it comes into play on your pay stub. John and I said check your bank accounts. So we're going to look at your deposits. If you have direct deposit, we know you work for ABC Company. That's great. If you get Social Security, we're going to know you get Social Security, and we're going to look for that Social Security benefit letter. Again, if the benefit letter is not included, it's an incomplete application. If you're transferring funds between your account and your checking and savings account, we're going to match up the account numbers. So we're going to know if you transfer, $100 on, March 14th, we're going to look for $100 on March 14th being transferred between accounts in your savings account. So where people have problems is you need to, if you have ATM deposits, mobile deposits, Cash App, Venmo, you need to identify where that money came from. If you don't, we're going to count it all as income on a monthly basis, and we're going to average it out for the year, and we're going to add it to your income. And that's where people get in trouble, because that's where people can be determined over income, all right? So before you submit your checking and savings accounts, go through, look at every deposit. And if it's not a payroll or Social Security, or it could be Fidelity or a pension, again, those things we should have the documentation, particularly if we see it repeated every month in your bank statements, okay? You need to provide the documentation because it comes down to we see it, we know it's income, we don't know if it's gross or if it's net. That's why you need to provide the backup documentation because we are going to match everything up with the paperwork you provide us. Those, again, over-the-counter, Cash App, Venmo, mobile apps, ATM deposits, you need to identify where that money came from, okay? We're not hard-nosed. Michael, this gets to your question. You look at your bank statement, just write on the bank statement birthday gift, all right? Or write on the statement that it was Venmo, someone paying me back for dinner or lunch. The problem with the Venmos, the Cash Apps, and all those, people are getting paid through those accounts now. So if we see funky dollar amounts, we don't know if it's someone paying you back or if that's a paycheck that you're receiving in your Venmo, okay? So that's why you need to identify everything. If you have Venmo, if you have Cash App in any one of those accounts, you need to provide the last 3 months statements of those accounts as well, all right? And again, identify the deposits because any non-identified deposit will count as income. We're not asking for backup documentation, but you can write right on the statements where that money's coming from. Because sometimes, believe it or not, people have part-time jobs and it goes into Venmo and we have no pay stubs, no nothing. So that's an incomplete application, all right? So your best thing to do when you're reviewing your checking and savings accounts, just say, does Maureen know where this money is from? If the answer is no, then you need to identify where that money's coming from, all right? Okay, the last three statements, checking and savings. Now, regarding how you spend your money, I pay very little attention to where your money's going, how you spend it. But I will go through the accounts really quickly to see if money's being transferred to Robinhood or Fidelity or Vanguard or to a bank account on a regular basis and I don't have it and you didn't identify it. So we will look for that information. But we don't, I don't look to how you spend your money. I don't care. It's none of my business. But I will just look for those other financial accounts that the money may be transferred out on a regular basis. I see it on every month and I don't have any backup documentation. We have a problem. Okay. So that's your checking and savings account. Now, some people will have prepaid, debit card, like if you get your Social Security on a Direct Express, or you have a Visa prepaid card or American Express prepaid card. Again, people are getting paid on these accounts. So you need to provide the last statement. No, need three, just the last statement. And it needs to show the money going in, the money going out, and what the current balance is. All right? And that way you tell me you're working for McDonald's or whatever, and they pay you on your on a debit card, then I can match it up and we're good to go, all right? So we're not real hard-nosed, but you need to provide us the documentation. And when I say we're not real hard-nosed, we're only following the state guidelines, okay? This is not made-up stuff. These are the state guidelines we need to follow for each and every applicant for rental and homeownership. Same stuff you got to provide. All right, if you have a revocable trust, we need a copy of the trust document because the value of that account counts towards your asset, all right? Investment accounts, stocks, bonds, treasuries, CDs, mutual funds, money market, Robinhood, Acorn, any one of those accounts, we only need the last statement. We don't need the last three, just the last statement. Same for your retirement, IRA, Roth, 401k, 403b, pensions, for all current and past jobs. We only need the last statement. Again, there is no asset limit for a rental, but it comes down to the 0.06% if you're over $5,000 counts towards your asset limit. All right, if you have a whole life or universal life insurance, there's a cash value to that, and this is an insurance policy that you are paying privately on a monthly basis. It is not the health insurance that you have through your job, okay? Because if you're no longer employed there, you no longer have a life insurance policy, okay? So these are only policies that you purchase on your own. They all have a cash, well, whole life and universal life has a cash value. That cash value is considered an asset. So you need to provide a statement from one or all the companies, however many you have, and it will break out surrender value. That's your cash value, and we will count that as an asset. If you have a term life insurance policy, there is no cash value to that account. So you don't need to submit it. Personal property held as an investment. I don't know what that is. I've been in this business 20-plus years. I've never had anyone personal property held as an investment. I don't know if it's antique car collection, rifle gun collection. I don't know. I've never had to work with it. Lump sum receipts or one-time receipts. For example, so you got a fat check from Social Security for back pay, that's an asset. That's not income. It's usually a one-time payment. If you got an insurance settlement, that's not income, that's asset, okay? If you got a fat check for back payment of child support, that's an asset, not income. So those are what the lump sum receipts or one-time receipts are, all right? Now, for students, if you have, as I mentioned, students 18 years of age or older, are their income and assets will count in determining your eligibility for the program. However, if you have an 18 or older student and they work, I'm sorry, they are a full-time student and they are a dependent on your tax return, we are only going to count $480 of their income towards your program eligibility. If they are a full-time student, or a part-time student, and they are not a dependent on your tax return, we are going to count their income as earned, same as you, in determining their income eligibility. Now, someone who's a part-time student, that means whether they're a dependent on your return or not, the full value of their salary or income will count towards your program income eligibility. If your household member is a student, they need to provide documentation that they're a student, where they go to school, and they need to provide proof that they are a full-time student. So usually people will send a letter from the college or their class schedule, so we can determine if they're full or part-time. All right, and we do check full or part-time status. We can get it from the school website, how many credits are full-time, how many credits are part-time. All right, a household, again, we've talked about if you're pregnant, the unborn child is considered a household member, but you must submit proof of the pregnancy with the application. We've already talked about if you're going through a divorce or separation, you need to be far enough along in the process that we know how your assets are being distributed, your family assets are being distributed. If you're not that far along, then you need to provide your soon-to-be ex's same information as yourself, and their income and assets, home buyer status, will count towards your program eligibility, all right? If you are going through a divorce and the home is being sold, your name needs to be off that home and off that deed before you qualify for an affordable apartment. I will include you in the lottery, but your house needs to be sold before you can sign a lease. And if it's not even on the market, I guarantee you the developer is not going to wait 2 to 3 months for you to sell your home. It's not going to happen. So just know that that's an issue if you have a home to sell. All right. So when you sit down, any question on the financial documentation you need to provide with the application? To me, this is the most important part of this entire meeting, because if you submit any of this incomplete, you're not going to be included in the lottery, and we're brutal. So if you forgot something, literally forgot something, I'm sorry you forgot it, but you're not going to be included in the lottery. So I would say when you fill your application out, you still have plenty of time. Read through it once, gather the documents, set it aside. In a couple days, read through it again, because I guarantee you, you've forgotten something. Read through it again, gather the additional documentation, set it aside, and then look at it the third time. Read through. If you're missing anything, you may or may not, then you can send it in, all right? But to sit down once, go through it, gather everything, inevitably you may have forgotten something. So don't rush it. You have until April 7th. If you're mailing in your information, your mail has to be postmarked on or before April 7th. If we get it within 2 weeks after the deadline, which would be April 21st, we will accept it. We will accept your application and review it for program eligibility. If we receive it after April 21st, you'll be added to the waiting list. The post office is incredibly slow these days, but and they recommend, because I went in and kind of complained to them how bad it is, and they suggested if you're mailing your information, to make sure you may want to consider sending it either certified or priority, so you have a tracking number and you can track where it is. We will accept email. You can drop it off in our office. We're located in Harvard, Mass., or you can fax it. So any way, we'll accept your application. Now, in here is also a release of information authorization form you need to complete and send it in. If you have custody, child support affidavit, if you have children, you need to submit that. And then the last thing is just going over what needs to be provided. So when you submit your application, you need to submit the completed, signed, and dated actual application, the signed and dated affidavit and disclosure form, signed and dated application tip information sheet, completed, signed, and dated the required personal identification and income verification documents, all the required financial and related documentation, complete, signed, and dated release of information authorization form, again, same for the custody and child support affidavit. If it's applicable, you need to complete one for each child. I don't think there will be more than one child at that. And then if you require a reasonable accommodation, you need to provide a lot documentation on that. What is not here, because I forgot to put it, local preference, you know, proof that you require that you're eligible for the local preference pool. So you need to provide that as well. And then get it to us by 11:59 on April 7th. Do renters have to go through it? Yes. Every year, as a renter, you need to be recertified for continued eligibility. Your initial eligibility is at 80% of the AMI, the area median income. When you're going through the recertification process, you can then earn up to 140% of AMI. The income limits change on an annual basis. Once HUD released, they haven't released the 2025 income limits yet. So when you go through recertification, we start at the income limits that are in place at the time you recertify. But for example, for using this year's numbers, if you're a single person, the maximum income is $91,200. So we're going to multiply that by 140%. So before you're determined ineligible for a unit, you can earn up to $127,680. So they allow for that, allowing for increase in your salary. So you don't have to move every year, because that's a pain in the neck. And I think you came in a little bit late, Michael. The rents aren't fixed. They will be adjusted on an annual basis. So they're not fixed rent. It starts at $2,150, which is less than you could have charged. $2,150, so it will go up next year. When you renew your lease, I guarantee it'll go up. How much? I don't know. I haven't gotten to that with the developer yet, and I won't for about a year. Okay, so I've gone through everything. Does anyone have any questions? Who the landlord be? I'm not exactly sure who the property manager is yet. Who's the developer? Giancarlo's my contact. I can't think of the name of the developer. But I'm not sure if they're managing the property or not, or if they're going to hire a company to do that. I will have that information prior to the lottery, because you need to know who you need to contact. But I don't have that now. I'm sorry. Okay, any other questions? All right. This meeting will be posted on our website tomorrow. And then, again, I cannot stress enough, we are here to assist you. If you have any questions, please call us and ask, or email us and ask. Any one of us in the office can answer the questions for you. Because I would just love, it would be such a gift to me if I can review every applicant that applied and they're all included in the lottery. It would be such a gift. But it's not going to happen, and I know it. But we are here to assist you, so take advantage of us, okay? If you don't have any other questions, I'm going to say goodnight so I can go home and have some dinner. The last page of the application has our phone number, email address, if you need to call or email with questions.